Hello and welcome to the Film Ireland podcast. I'm Gemma Cray.
I'm chatting with filmmakers Christina Molloy and Joe Lawler about their powerful period drama, Baltimore. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you, Gemma.
Baltimore is a very, very powerful piece of writing first. Let's start off with how the script formed. How were you guys drawn to the story?
We began this story, the genesis of the story was in a documentary essay film that we did that actually was in Dublin last year. And it was about, essentially it was a story, our reaction to Brexit, having lived in London or the UK for quite a while. And it's a story of us simply going from London to Dublin. And as we look out the window, lots of various thoughts flood to our mind, including when we first came over to an art college here in the late 80s. One of the stories, or one of the people that we followed, was Rose Dugdale, who our art college was in Devon. She left Devon to come to Ireland. So there was a kind of a nice kind of circular kind of route there that we were following. And the more we were kind of researching why somebody would feel out of sorts with who they are, the body that they grew up in and becoming somebody else, we kind of, it chimed with us in various ways, not necessarily in the action that she pursued, but there was something about that fish out of water and a desire to travel and go somewhere else or seek a cause or seek meaning. And out of that, we thought, we started this about 4 or 5 years ago, and the pandemic knocked it sideways. We did eventually get it finished. And we began to think, this is an interesting story. I wonder if it would withstand a screenplay. Not everything does. Sometimes you embark on a screenplay and you get to 20, 30 pages and go, you know, I think this is run out of steam. But that just kept getting stronger and stronger. So that's how it, that was its original origin. That doesn't make sense. Original. That was his origin. And that's how we gave birth to it, out of the future.
In a way, when making the documentary, The Future Tense, we stumbled across her story. Now, if I thought really, really hard, maybe I can vaguely remember the story of Rose Dugdale when I was, you know, young, grown up in Ireland in the 60s, 70s. Joe says that he can remember the story. And I guess it would have been such a big story at the time. I've just read recently that it wasn't long after Rusper House that Patty Hearst was kidnapped. So you had two heiresses in different parts of the world, both being pulled into these kind of, you know, revolutionary organisations, very different, of course, and in different contexts. But I guess it tells you something about the, you know, the fervor of the times, and they were different times to the times that we're growing up or that we're in right now. But yes, you know, these stories that come and go at the time, they're huge, you know, they're grabbing headlines all over the world. And unsurprisingly, she would have been a very curious character and quite an anomaly in given the troubles and, you know, the people that you would associate with that period of Irish history. I guess the fact that we've lived over in the UK since the 80s, and as Joe said, you know, we've spent a number of years living in Devon. We were just attracted to her story. It stood out for us. And what was a small kind of seed when we were making the documentary, slowly but surely became this bigger thing. And as Joe said, until we, you know, got stuck into the script.
And talk to me about your process working collaboratively. Does this start out as a bunch of discussions around character? Does it start out like a one-page treatment? How do you guys build the script from the story?
Yeah, I think it does build. I think we sometimes do use architectural language that you build the structure of something incrementally. It's not going to, nobody really, or we certainly wouldn't be just launching straight into a screenplay. You would have to kind of build things up slowly. So yeah, you would begin by conversations, walks. We like to walk and talk through ideas. At some point, of course, those ideas have to be set down. Yes, that is a one-page outline. Then that becomes maybe a five-page treatment. then a 12-page treatment. And once you get to a 12, 15-page treatment, you're probably ready to start beginning a screenplay and all the various kind of scenes that go in between the big story beats. And this was reasonably quick for us. So
we've
never
worked with a story that's
based on something.
Real events, yeah, that's true. Story. So we've never worked that way before. So, of course, so many of the elements are there because they happened. And then the research you embark on, you build up the other elements that you're interested in or going to inform your take on the events, because it's not a biopic. As you know, Gemma, it's a lot more impressionistic than that. And we're trying to understand her as a character, which, of course, we can't fully do. All we're doing is speculating. And that, of course, comes as much from us as it does interrogating the material that we began to build up around her story. But there isn't a huge amount, at the time, there wasn't a huge amount written about her, really. Her story kind of came and went. But weirdly, more recently, more things have emerged, and there's a couple of books that have come out, in the last year or two. So maybe it's just one of those stories that is grabbing people's imagination again. Her story certainly grabbed ours.
Then talk to me about, again, you know the main beats of the story, and it's a very nonlinear form of storytelling, which I really enjoy. Like we're almost in her mind, and that kind of breakdown of like her arc, and like those leaps in time, elements of magic realism. Like it's very wonderful and complex, and I love how it's very much from her perspective, and the shift is there. Now, that was something that was that there from draft one, and it was a case of honing it and getting down to it. Was that something you kind of uncovered as you were working on different drafts?
It really did come pretty much formed like that. I think we were approaching it very much like we were using our kind of jumping off point, the visual art lesson, which was the structure of the film as a triptych. So we had these three narratives that could intersect with each other. And so that would inevitably mean kind of slightly more abrasive editing. And so you'd get these ruptures, you'd finish something and just jump in to another world, very much like a triptych. You watch a three paneled painting and you get to the edge and you're straight into the other one. So that was one of the big things that happened in draft one, that form came part and parcel of that. And there for draft two and three, which followed quite quickly after that, I think we would have started about 3-4 years ago on this whole process. But the writing probably took 3 years,
yeah,
on and off,
two and a half. Yeah.
which is quite quick. Normally, sometimes that can take a bit longer or a good bit longer. And so that was really important, because what we didn't want to do, as Kristen said, is, I don't know what your feeling is, but we're convinced, we might be delusional, that it doesn't feel like a biopic. It feels like something else. And so it doesn't. And I think part of the reason it doesn't is because time and the structure militates against that flow of chronology, and sitting into the character psychology in a chronological fashion. We didn't really want to do that. We were more interested in the ideas and how they might cross-fertilize with each other. So, for example, we never met her. We're not interested in meeting her. That would have felt like now we're going to have to get into her as a person. We weren't really that interested in, all the little nooks and crannies of her, rather than the bigger idea of a human being growing up in one context, not sure about it, then becoming critical of it, and then railing against it. And it was that transformation over time, that radicalization, that was the thing that really we were interested in.
When did ye maybe get Screen Ireland involved, or when did you reach out to go, okay, like, look, we've something polished enough, we need a script editor to edit it down, or we want development funding to get more money? When does that happen?
At one stage along the way, we applied to a fund that Screen Ireland, I'm trying to think with the Irish Film Board then, let's say Screen Ireland, I can't remember now, And they had a fund for writers. So writers who had a bit of experience where you can just focus on the writing and not get too bogged down in, you know, setting up, you know, agreements with producers and things being pushed into a different space. So it's, here's some money, a small amount of money that allows you to write. And out of that, we did the first draft of the script. And as Joe said, we were making the documentary at the same time. These two things were going hand in hand. And we've worked with an Irish producer, David Collins, who's got a company called Samson Films. And we've worked with him for a number of years now. This is actually the third feature film we've made with Davis. And at some point we shared the script with Davis. And so then you're into the next stage. I seem to remember that we did the second draft on spec. So we wrote the second draft of the script on spec, which means basically that you write it and you're not being paid any money to write it. And to get it into a stronger place. And then that stage, we were working with David towards trying to, you know, put the finance together and make the project happen. And that's when Screen Ireland became much more involved, and they helped us with the third draft financially. They gave us some development money, and then they also, very luckily for us, agreed to fund the film. I mean, it's a, relatively speaking, it's a small budget film, you know, as it would be described. It's in that kind of category. So, you know, it meant that we were quite reasonably nimble. And once we were good to go, we could move quite quickly. And at the end of the day, that came down to Imogen. Because once Imogen came on board, once we'd approached her and she said she was really keen, we then, you know, wanted to keep hold of her, because, you know, it's a tricky business. People get different offers. And, you know, if you can't keep somebody waiting forever, well, they wouldn't anyway. So we, you know, were able to shoot the film last year. Oh my God, it was only a year ago. So November, December of 2022, because that was the one window of availability that Imogen had. So come hell or high water, we were going to work with her. And luckily we did.
And it's funny you say that it's a small budget film, because the production value is outstanding. The period, like it's very gorgeous period piece. There's beautiful set design. There's beautiful costume. Like, I'm sure all that takes time and effort to come together. How did you wrangle it for the lower budget?
It really
We're
does.
Laughing here.
No, well, that's when you get some great people like Maeve Patterson or John Hand.
Our costumes, John for production design, Tom Comerford, our DOP.
And so everybody begins to, well, you know, they're really good at what they do. And so they know they have very constrained budgets.
Not an awful lot of time.
You know, luckily, in a lot of places, vintage shops or secondhand shops, there's a kind of a lot of 70s clothes. And Maeve has kind of a couple of warehouses, so she can always have these go-to kind of places. The big question is really locations, where you're trying to choose a place and you're hoping that, you know, as you rock up on day 15, you're thinking, is this the day that our budget, you know, is mm-hmm. going to, you know, reveal our weakness, or can we somehow frame it? And I guess that's the art of cinema, really. I mean, there is that kind of great conversation between Sidney Lumet and Akira Kurosawa when they're talking about an opening shot of Rashomon. And Sidney Lumet is asking Kurosawa, why did you choose that? And he said, well, if you pan the camera to the left, you'll see the Sony factory, and to the right, you'll see the airport. So I guess the camera is quite good at selecting the frame, so you don't, you know, we cut our cloth, so to speak. So you're not going to, you're going to do a film set in the 70s or 50s and 50s, but you're going to keep the narrow, you're going to keep it really narrow. You're not going to have an open street with 500 people and walking down, you know, forget about it. We could only afford it for, you know, 5-6 cars. That kind of thing.
As I said, we had to come together and make it work really, really quickly. So our prep was just under 4 weeks, which isn't long. And I say hats off to our heads of departments, like production design, John Hand and Maeve Patterson. Brilliant job. And hair and makeup, Lindsay Heron and our DOP, Tom Comfort, and their teams, people worked really hard above and beyond, because it wasn't a huge amount of time to actually prep what needed to be done. But then you get some lucky breaks, like trying to find the house that would stand in for us for house, and finding Harristown House and Hubert, the owner of the house, and being open and welcome to the idea, and maybe, you know, maybe going against, you know, what he really felt he ought to be doing, because, you know, it's a real imposition to open up your home. And Hubert had something that we really wanted, which was a family home, because if you go to Roxburgh House now, it is an amazing place to visit. It's not a family home, it's a museum. Whereas Harristown House is still a family home. So, you know, you need those lucky breaks along the way, and we certainly had us with our locations. Our location managers did a great job.
But you can't screw up. If you're choosing a period, you got to go through all the way. Otherwise, everything just collapses. And I think everybody knows what we're trying to do here. So,
and it is wonderful. I love the Garda car at the end. You're like, wow, it almost felt older. You're like, it's funny when you look back at a period, you're like, oh my God, I actually thought that was like before. That's insane. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I tell you, trying to get cars, vintage cars, that's the biggest hurdle ever. And trying to get vintage cars that actually move and the engine still works, honestly. And then our location was so inhospitable to cars. Oh my God, that's almost triggering, like bringing back nightmare memories. But yeah, the police car looked great. We love that car.
So yeah, it sounded like a very agile shoot then, and getting it across. Like, I'd love to chat a little bit more about the photography of the film and the visuals, because there were so many shots that looked like that kind of classic period of painting, the way that the light was a source, the way everything was framed. And was this, when you're coming up with the visual style, do you guys have very strong mood boards, or is it a little bit of happenstance because of the nature of the production?
No, it's definitely a strong idea that you have. And you're quite right. There is a kind of like a painterliness, and we were certainly leaning into that in some scenes more than others, you know. So consequently, you know, if we were here, a lot of side lighting as opposed to front on. And that feeling is something that we wanted. And of course, that's something that we'd worked with Tom before. And, you know, and he was very keen on that as well, because he's a great eye, and he's totally up for visually trying to explore, make things look as compelling as possible. I mean, you know, the images are really important. I think the format's also very important, that we're shooting on CinemaScope. We've always shot CinemaScope from our first film to this film. It's an important kind of aspect ratio for us. It feels like the aspect ratio of cinema. That certainly is the case when we've seen it in cinema screens. Hopefully people will like the look of that on the big screen. Images matter, and images really matter in storytelling. And I think we were very keen that, if nothing else, that the images really resonated for audiences, and the experience of watching them, particularly in a cinema, was worth it. It's worth going to see it in a cinema, because it lends itself. Not all films do. And some films sometimes have a TV quality to it. But sometimes when we see films that have a more cinematic quality to them, it's great if people can see that in the cinema.
And definitely there's, I think, the sound mix as well. Like, that, you can really imagine, like, listening to that at the way it's layered, the composition, like, it is so cinematic, and it's in its overall experience totally. I do want to get into the post, but actually I'm very curious to, can you tell me, working as two directors, two writers, and two editors, how does the workflow work when it comes to you know, divvying up the tasks, like writing the script first of all, then when on set, like, it is, how are decisions made on the day? Do one of you kind of lean into different areas?
Writing is more straightforward, because we've got an approach. Joe normally get the first draft done, and then it'll go back and forth between the two of us. Editing's pretty straightforward. I normally take the lead on editing, but not entirely. So we still work between the two of us, but we're trying to play into our strengths. Directing is a little bit more tricky, number one, because you don't do that much of it. And number two, on the day, it's all in the moment. So we try as much as possible to be very prepared before we, you know, turn up on set and try and get through the day and to be both speaking off the same page as much as possible. Although you are pulled in different directions, you know, because it's all pretty Speedy Gonzales and quite pressurized. And, you know, that's always a challenge for us to try and make that work with the two of us. You could say you get two for the price of one. That's probably true, but all of our work we make together. So I just see it as one. it's not two people pulling in different directions, but yeah, on set it can be, figure it out as you go along and try and make it work.
I suppose the thing about writing and editing is that they're very similar in some respects. They have a lot in common with each other. And so I will lead on writing, not exclusively. Christine leads on editing, not exclusively, but they're kind of the same thing in other words. And you get lots of opportunities to have another go at it. Mm-hmm. And so you can keep going at it. And if it's not working, you can come back the next day, it's fine. And then try it from a different perspective. You can't do that with directing. It's nuts. It's like going into war, and you've got, you know, in the Baltimore case, you've got 25 days and every day is a schedule. And the night before we will game out the scene because you've got your sides, and you will game out what the scenes are and what the shot list might be approximately. And then you hold that back, or we hold that back, and allow ourselves to try and respond to the moment, to the performances. So we would never tell an actor what to do or where to go or how to walk and where to walk. You know what I mean? So we're trying to be open enough to the moment. So there's a kind of like a freshness to it. But you've got to do that in 45 minutes.
So you're always battling against other things.
Time is a big enemy.
There are restrictions of time. And, you know, I would say you have to be pretty prepared to work in the moment. So be quite nimble on your feet, respond to things and let things go. Because at the end of the day, you want to film everything that you're meant to film. And if you get really stuck and stubborn and won't let go, you'll lose some of your day. And that's an absolute nightmare at this level of, you know, film production. Every single, you know, every day counts in terms of getting all the scenes shot that you're meant to shoot. So myself and Joe, when we're editing and writing, editing maybe even more so, God, that's hard to know, we can be quite argumentative. So we do shout at each other a lot. Our daughter has learned to, you know, go for a walk and leave us to us, and she knows it's a work argument. I think that's difficult on set. So, you know, you don't get to let off all the steam, maybe until you get home, because you don't want to let yourself down in front of crew and cast. You just have got to get on with this, basically.
That sounds like we're working together. The back end of the day isn't going great. You say thanks to everyone, get in the car and go, well, that was a fucking shit show. You're a fucking moron. Well, fuck you. Yeah. What the fuck are you talking about? What the fuck are you?
A peek behind the curtain.
Oh yeah.
Because it's so stressful, like, and it is like if you haven't watched the rushes back and you have to move on to the next scene, like you're like, is it there? Is it there? But I mean, with a cast like this cast, I presume it was always there as long as it wasn't focused in some ways. what a brilliant chemistry, layered performance, subtle performances, tension. Tell me about working with them.
Well, first of all, I'd like to give a thumbs up to Emma Gunnery, our casting director. And this is the second time we've worked with Emma. Now, we had Imogen on our minds, and Emma really got behind that idea and, you know, worked with us and to get Imogen on board. In terms of the rest of the cast, because we moved quick, we had to pull people together really fast. So you have a kind of a wish list, and, you know, Emma, you know, really worked with us on that and put people together. So I think, you know, it's just, it's the look of the draw in some respects, who's available, who isn't. But if you have a wish list and you've got somebody like Tom Von Lawler on the wish list, and then you manage by hook or crook to get Tom, you know, it's just fantastic. It's such a great feeling. I know that Emma thought that things would begin to move once she got Dermot Crowley on board. Now, Dermot wasn't, he wasn't somebody who was saying, we've got to work with Dermot. This was somebody who Emma brought to us, you know, along with some other names, but he was her, you know, top choice. And so when Dermot came on board, she also felt we'll pull a good cast together. And we were just kind of blown away by the, you know, like working with John Kavanagh and Andrea Irvine and Carrie Crowley and Simon Curry and everyone else who was on board. I mean, lucky us. And they were all up for us. And yeah, it's, Imogen was so good to work with. It all kind of stems from the, I think, the main person. What are they like? Imogen was a total pleasure. And I think Imogen didn't know many members of the cast, and she hadn't worked with them before. She didn't know Tom. And of course, that's going to be a big relationship for her in the, you know, in the film. And, you know, after day one, she came up to us and says, he's fantastic, you know. And, well, vice versa, Tom said the same about Imogen. And, you know, her first scenes were with Dermot, and a nicer man you couldn't find, and a more kind of brilliant actor to work with. So we just got, yeah, I think we got quite lucky. And I, you know, we're really grateful to Emma for pulling under the pressure she was under that cast together for us.
Well, it's great work. Like, all the roles are so meaty as well. I can see it being a big draw for, like, if you're an actor, like, I can't imagine many roles like that. For all of the roles that you mentioned come across your desk too often as well, because it's such an interesting script. Was there anything in that process that changed? Like as you guys got into pre-production, was there any sort of limitations that you guys had to work within that maybe changed some of the narrative, or would that have already been kind of sorted out before it reached that?
Yeah, I mean, but there was lots of things that did change, because we, you know, up until, you know, we started to do prep, we actually thought if we couldn't get to Baltimore, we'd get to some fishing village that's very remote. We really did. We were looking at Lanann, for example, or, you know, but of course, the reality is that wasn't going to happen. And when we got there, we thought, you know, that's like another budget level up. And so we won't be all decamping down to, you know, the west of Ireland or Kerry for a week just to shoot a pier scene, you know, or a phone, you know, it just isn't going to happen. And so, or for example, a big thing that came early on in the first week was the raid actually in reality happened at night. And we were looking at locations, you know, when they were getting away in the car at night with night lighting, shooting. Although it's in the winter, your kind of calls would be for, you know, 1 PM till midnight, you know what I mean? Because it's getting dark around 4 or 5 or something like that. And so then Christine had this idea to Tom, who was already stressed out about the amount of lights that were going to be required for nighttime
split days,
and everyone gets exhausted. Yeah. And, and Kristen was saying, like, would it be easier if this way it happened in the daytime? And it was like, oh my God, that's going to help everyone so much, because now you're going to have a regular day of 8 in the morning till 6 in the evening or 7 in the evening. So those kind of adjustments, partly based on our experience having made several films, you just keep pivoting, because if you don't pivot and you hold on doggedly to a thing that isn't worth hanging on to, you will come a cropper and you will be fighting against things as opposed to going with the flow. But sometimes you don't know that until you've been around the block a few times. So that would be, they were two examples of having to make big changes that had a big knock-on effect on everything, but for the better. But you're always wondering. I remember John Hann said, guys, I wonder, are you making, you know, some, are the compromises too big sometimes? And we said, we don't know, but we have to work in this way. Otherwise, this film isn't going to be possible. So that's it. It's constant ducking and diving. So the day you start photography, then it goes, and that's it. All the commitments that you've made and all the sacrifices and the, you know, if you look at the original script, the first 30 pages are more or less gone. And so all of that's gone. So it's kind of amazing, you know, the changes that you can do quite quickly. But as long as you know the material, you'll be okay. You can keep changing and pivoting and reimagining. But you've got to know the story and you've got to know the material that you're trying to express. Other than that, I think you could get lost.
And talk to me then about editing this. So, like, that's 25 days worth of footage. Do you kind of take a little break? Is there more flexibility in that year editing it yourself? How does that begin and take shape? Besides arguing.
Then the arguments really began. We certainly weren't really in a position to take a break, although a break's kind of forced us because of Christmas and the new year.
Yeah.
We could kind of draw a breath. And then you're always under pressure because we need to get the thing edited so that, you know, we can begin to, well, number one, draw down the rest of the money and keep to a schedule and try and get the film into ready for festivals, etc. And then we've worked with the composer, Stephen McKeown, on two of our previous films. And we were working with Stephen again. You know, he's got schedules. Our phonic, who did our sound post-production, they've got a schedule. So we're trying to work to help everyone so that we can all bring, you know, our best to the job. I mean, we love the post-production end of it, it has to be said. But, you know, it wasn't without its challenges and, you know, you're just trying to find your way with the film. It's always a bit unwieldy until it begins to take shape. And it's very exciting for us when we start to reach a stage where, you know, like Stephen is coming on board with his ideas and Fana could do our sound, are bringing to the table what they bring to the table, and then Splice do the post-production, things like the grade. When it starts to come together, it's a relief and it's exciting. You still don't really know what you have, but at least you can see if, you know, you're approaching the finishing line after all the work.
And do you find, like, I mean, again, something like this that's so not traditionally structured, did, like, if anything move then in the edit? Whether, you know, like, a pacing is so important, like, the, you know, the different kind of timelines, did anything sort of shift or maneuver, or was that sort of mentally locked in place?
No, I mean, we did one crazy pass at the beginning, actually. It was quite fun to do, which was to take all the heist, this wasn't in the script, was to take all the back-to-back heist moments in the house, put them at the opening of the film. So not a triptych structure. And so it was going to be, a diptych. It would be all the heist and then in the cottage and her backstory. And it didn't work, but it was an interesting thing to do. And what was interesting about it is that even though we hadn't shot it like that, it actually did edit together well, you know, but it was never shot with that in mind. But you could go from A to B to C, even though we weren't shooting it chronologically. But of course, the film would only then be, that would be 25 minutes long, and then what? So people would know how it ended. And so, but it was a good exercise to do, and it certainly made everyone sort of pay attention and say, oh, can we please do it in the way the script is? So, which was the right way to do it, of course. But it was good to mine the material, yeah, to really stress test it, to see where were the edges of it. And then we kind of got...
I think it was a challenge, it has to be said, because it's not conventionally edited. And we do kind of move between these timelines, and we just kind of crash land into, you know, the time of the heist, or we come back to the cottage, or we, you know, go back to when she was younger. We just keep moving from one to the other. So it does do something to the flow, and, you know, that's kind of challenging, but we think it brings a lot to the film as well. So it's about steadying your nerve, and obviously we didn't begin with in the first pass, the first edit that we did. It was very, and we learned a huge amount from that. And then we, sometimes you think, okay, we're, it's a genre film on the one hand, but for us, it's a character study, and that's the most important thing. So what are we trying to really make work and to get rise? We're trying to get everything rise, but keep, for us to keep our eye on what we think it is and what we're about in terms of the way we want to approach these, this event, these, this story. It's always trying to bear that in mind and holding your nerve, really.
Well, you know, some, I mean, you really do have to hold your nerve on this. I remember we did a film with Aidan Gillen. It was called Mr. John. It was set in Singapore. And, you know, so, but there was an edit in there. And just before we committed to the edit, we cut out around 12 minutes. And it, we lost 12 minutes. It's quite big. But every so often, I think about those 12 minutes. And but I think, oh, was that really the right thing to do? Because everybody, nobody ever says, oh, can you make it longer? Everybody wants it shorter. And there were some people that we that were looking at the edit who did say, oh, that scene between the two guys when they're overlooking the estuary when they're talking about heaven and Tom being in the seminary, it's a really good scene, but what's it about and do we really need it? Or the scene with Donal in the farmhouse where she goes to potentially size up whether she'll kill him or not. Do we need all of it? Like when he's talking about being blind or when he's talking about his friend Paddy Casey with the milk, can we not just cut all of that? And we're going, fuck off. That's when you know you're, you know, you've got to be really careful that those very same people might be good at certain parts of the film, but disastrous at that kind of end of the film, like the character stuff, the more kind of esoteric, philosophical stuff. But that's kind of what the film's about as well. So we always do believe in sharing the edits with people, and very good to get different cross-section of feedback. It's good that it builds up the immune system, because that's going to, you know, you will be showing it to people eventually. So you better start getting, doing that early. But just realize that people might come back with notes you don't always agree with, and that doesn't mean that they're right.
That's very interesting that it, you go with your gut, because you kind of also think, is there a point where you don't see things? If you've been in the edit and you've been kind of smooshing things around so much, like you stop getting that objective view. So it's about going, well, actually, if you're really still not feeling it, and you, this is a darling that you know you don't want to kill, or was there anything that you in the past had been like, actually, I should have killed those darlings. That is too long.
No, not in terms. Our films don't tend to be too long. You know, as Joe said, there's edits of our films that maybe we would have been quite partial to, but we would accept that, you know, we're not getting the support. But there's always a different version of a film. That's a fact. We would have done quite a few cuts of this film. We like to, you know, go away or remove ourselves completely once we hand a cut over and don't engage the material at all while people are looking at it and giving us notes, just so you can get that, you know, so you can see the wood for the trees again, because you do get really kind of sucked in. But I guess you're trying to wrestle with the material to find the shape of the film that is the shape that you want it to be, and to stick to that as much as possible, accepting that there's other stakeholders who've probably got some interesting things to say. And I like to engage what people say and test stress us, and so that not just dismiss things out of hand. But
I'm okay with dismissing things. I can dismiss things quite easily. And I'm up to a point we'll listen to people. So I'm less tolerant than an open-minded
I'm not
Christian.
Tolerant to the point that I will do what people say because they've said us. But I will at least say, okay, well, this is what you think. Well, what would that mean? And what would that look like? So there you go. Can we just go back to where we were?
We don't edit together. So I think the main thing is that Christine edits day by day, hour by hour. And I might look at it at the end of the day or at the end of the week. You know what I mean? So we used not to do that. We used to edit together. Yeah. But then nobody else has a different perspective. So it's good to have a different perspective. And even editors need to take breaks as well. So professional editors, they're also prone to, you know, falling in love with some of the maneuvers that they do. And so hence the importance of opening it up every, whatever, 6 weeks, 2 months, and sharing it.
Mm. Brilliant. And thank you so much for chatting with us.
Gemma, thank you very much.